my surgeons, I don't put Reboa in dead people, and I don't open live people. That's a great one. All right, we get more Shirley Chang coming up here, neurocritical care. Can you find it?
Can you hear me? There we go. No financial disclosures. We're going to be talking about some of the signs and symptoms of intracranial hypertension, monitoring intracranial pressure, sometimes non-invasively, and then talk about management. So we all look for signs and symptoms of headache. Oftentimes people are thinking about somnolence, but one of the things I want you to remember is that oftentimes patients, especially young ones, start getting agitated. So if someone comes in with head injury or even intracerebral hemorrhage, they start getting agitated. Older people tend to be somnolent first. So, and then we'll talk about hypertension. So with patients, when their intracranial pressure is starting to climb, remember cerebral perfusion pressure is going to equal your MAP minus ICP. So as ICP goes up, the MAP's going to go up to keep the CPP the same. So that's the first one of the early signs as well. And then, of course, we don't want to wait till herniation. You're seeing compression of structures with uncle herniation. I remind the students at our place that the Cushing's triad is late, that if you're waiting to see the bradycardia when you're starting to get the carotid baroreceptors, you get the ataxic breathing when you're coning the medulla, that's getting really late. But those early signs, and remember, watch for agitation, because sometimes the first thing your nurse is asking for is a bunch of fentanyl or some Versed, but really you should be thinking, should I be giving that patient mannitol, hypertonic saline? So we know that there's direct ICP monitoring, but there's other indirect things that I wanted to talk about. I mean, we have that measure of the systemic blood pressure, but we're going to talk a little bit about using your POCUS, which I know you're using a lot in the EM, the emergency department, but the optic nerve sheath diameter, pupillary function using pupillometers and transcranial Dopplers. So we all know this. The gold standard is an intraventricular monitor. You have to call the neurosurgeon down. The intraparenchymal monitor is now more commonly used, less invasive, and uses fiber optic strain gauge. There's a microchip. There's air pulse, which has gone a little bit off the side. But we don't typically see the Richardson subarachnoid screws. The subdurals can sometimes be put in the OR with the neurosurgeon, but they're not very accurate. And the epidurals that they used to use when they were worried about patients with high intracranial pressure with hepatic, you know, potentially patients with bleeding, risk for bleeding. We know epidurals are not very effective for accurate monitoring. So again, intraparenchymal monitors for those patients. So we're used to looking at this terrible number. We want to see less than 22. But think about non-invasive technologies potentially. A fast way to do it with point-of-care ultrasound is using the optic nerve sheath diameter, and we'll get to the others in a minute. So the optic nerve sheath diameter, and again, I don't have a great pointer here, but if you look on the bottom right, you're looking at the ocular globe and the optic nerve, which is in the yellow. But the outer line is the optic nerve sheath diameter. The different measurements that you see there, normal median's probably in the fours or so, and when you get beyond 5.5 in most populations, that's abnormal. So what typically you do is you put like an Opsite or Tegaderm over the eye so that you're not getting gel inside the eye, and then using the correct modality on your ultrasound. So you don't want to use the really full strength that you'd be using to do a fast. You want to use the one that you use for the eyes, because otherwise you can displace the lens. So definitely use the correct setting on the machine. And then you're going to be going, and it's kind of small to see, but you measure 3 millimeters behind that optic disc. And then at the 3 millimeter mark, you'll see the narrower one, which is the optic nerve diameter, but you actually want the optic sheath nerve diameter on the outer side, and looking at those numbers. So this is showing that when you, it correlates with the ICP, and when they looked at the normal groups of mildly elevated groups and severely elevated, and ICP, so normal being 7 in that second column versus the optic nerve sheath diameter, it was 4.9, as we talked about. As it starts getting elevated, it's above 5.5, And it's a direct linear correlation that can be very helpful to see that. So if you're wondering if that's an issue, you can use that modality in both eyes. You're typically supposed to do at least three different, or at least two or three different checks on each eye if you want to be accurate. So the other thing you can do is obviously look at the size. And they now have what a resident could call the I can't check pupillary size because they don't have a funny machine. Well, you always have a flashlight. But these machines can look at the pupillary size, and we know it changes. Pupils change depending on other things, too, emotionally relevant stimuli, mental effort. You can have problems or differences with a senile meiosis with people that are older. But these machines look at different things. And what the NPI, so this is a neurologic pupillary index, and you can see in that blue part there, if it's above 3, that's normal, and below 3 is felt to be abnormal. What it's doing is looking at, the nurses usually read in that upper right-hand corner the NPI, but you want to look at the further right, and you're looking at both the size, max size, and you're looking whether there's anisocoria, so that goes into the NPI. It also looks at the CH is the constriction change, so it should be greater than 10%, and then the constriction velocity, the CV, should be greater than 0.85 millimeters per second. They use an algorithm to calculate an MPI, so if your nurse comes up to you and says, oh, the MPI is less than 3, that is worrisome. It tells you that the pupil's not very reactive and may have some anisocoria and also, you know, the slow changes. So that can be helpful, but remember, there's still the flashlight that you can look at pupils that way. But there's more and more literature arising that this is well correlated for early detection, potentially, of problems with ICP. And then there's the transcranial Doppler, not as useful in an emergency department, though, but just to be aware, we incinate in the thinnest portion of the skull, which is the temporal bone. And fortunately, we have to look, remember our principles of physics, you have to look at something that comes parallel. So the parallel MCA flow is coming out towards the probe, so you have that positive inflection, and then it goes into diastolic. So normal looks like the normal waveform here on the left-hand side. Then as you get higher flow, you can see the big changes in that pulse pressure-looking area. And then as the CPP is much higher, becomes less and less above the ICP, then that's going to be an issue, and you can see that you go into this biphasic flow. When the patient becomes brain dead, you see towards the end where there's the systolic spikes, but these are issues where you see these high peaks that can be an elevation of ICP. So the next would be, so that's the way that we might be able to detect ICP issues. I want to talk then about how we treat these. You have to think, we want to try and prevent the injury, of course, but when we can't prevent it, we have to think about the penumbra, so the area around the area of injury that we might recover. We don't want to have secondary injury, which may be due to seizures, more metabolic insults. There's listed drugs on board. Hyperthermia can be an issue, and now some hyperchloremia, and we'll talk about some of that literature. So acute management are things that we all know. Make sure the patient's oxygenated, they're well perfused. In patients with altered mental status, we have to think about the glucose and thiamine and neurosurgery evaluation. We want to stop seizures, make sure they're metabolically not in disarray, and make sure that they're not hyperglycemic, and potentially areas of ischemia might be getting too much substrate, so we want to control that. Treat infection, and this is more ICU, early nutrition, DVT prophylaxis, corneal protection. So when we're standing at the bedside, you go, oh, no, she's going all the way back to medical school. But when I'm standing at the bedside, I'm thinking these basic premises is that, first of all, inside that patient's skull, there's their brain, their CSF, and their blood. And if there's something that's inside there that's not supposed to be there, something has to compensate. Otherwise, you're going to have ICP elevation. And that depends on the brain compliance, the volume-to-pressure relation. So you can imagine that as the volume goes up, initially, if you have a lot of area of compliance, you're not going to have high ICPs. So here's a larger volume. So in an older person who has a lot of volume, they have a big subdural, their ICP may not go up too high, as opposed to a younger person who's got more brain tissue. And I'm thinking, okay, so if that person has a large hemorrhage, they're going to have a problem with ICP elevation, whereas the older person, I know I might have a little bit of room. So it's important to look at the scan, see how much atrophy is going on. It may give you some more room. Remember, with TBI, what's happening is interstitial fluid, because the edema is going to go up. So they're showing in normal adult, and this is in animals, that automatically that compliance curve steepens. So you're going to be, any kind of change in volume is going to increase the ICP. So the third thing is cerebral autoregulation. And again, this is all going through your head as you're standing at the bedside, is thinking, okay, what this is, we know that we're able to keep our cerebral blood flow constant as we increase the blood pressure, because what's happening is, you see the circles, is that you're going to vasoconstrict to keep the blood flow the same. The interesting thing is that if you look at that, the ICP, if you're very tight and you're very, don't have a lot of compliance, just by changing that small volume in the vessels, you actually can decrease the intracerebral pressure a little bit. But then some of the problems that we're dealing with is that if you if the blood pressure drops too low, you can't vasodilate too much, you get ischemia, and then you get edema as you go higher up. What happens in our patients with brain injury, whether it's a stroke in that upper corner there, it's a traumatic, it's an intracerebral hemorrhage or traumatic contusions, is that you have a straight line of autoregulation. So if your blood pressure is running high, you're running edema and making the ICP potentially higher in that patient. Too low, of course, you're going to be ischemic. And this is all happening in areas of penumbra. The autoregulation that we saw before is happening in good brains. This is what's happening in bad brain. So we do need to think about what our blood pressure is doing in these patients, because we may be causing more problems, more edema, if we let that patient's blood pressure run too high. And the last is that concept I already talked about a little bit, CPP equals MAP minus ICP. So we know normal is about 70 to 100, adequate is 50 to 60, and then ischemia at the lower ranges. So one of the things when you're standing at the patient's bedside, or you're getting called to the bedside with the nurse, and you know that there's something inside the head, if the blood pressure's up, this may be autoregulation, and it might be a sign of ICP, as I mentioned before. If you're starting to give clavidipine or nicardipine and trying to defeat this autoregulation, you may be causing more damage. And so if you see the numbers there, so our ICP typically is 5. So our MAP's normally about 75 to keep that CPP of 70. But think if your ICP goes up, let's say to 40. So to keep your CPP the same up at 70, your MAP's climbing up to 110. Now, if you were just going to treat that mean arterial pressure and drop that to 75, and you haven't treated your ICP, you've just made your CPP 35. So what I do in this situation, like, I don't know if this is because they've got a big ICH in their head or their trauma and they've got a subdural going on, that their blood pressure's high. What should I do? And in this case, where I would use hypertonic saline. So if I gave all of us a bolus of hypertonic saline, hopefully our blood pressure would go up. We're giving us a fluid bolus. But in this situation, if you give hypertonic saline, the ICP comes down, the MAP comes down. So it's kind of paradoxical. So I call it a therapeutic diagnostic maneuver. So if that happens, you give a bolus of hypertonic saline, blood pressure comes down, you're like, oh shoot, I really got a problem with ICP. So you really need to start thinking about getting that patient managed. So we have guidelines, and you know, you don't want to wear your helmet backwards or do kind of crazy things like this, but we do have some guidelines. They're unfortunately not very robust, but that's what we have. There was the third edition that was out in 2007. Now that there's a little bit more recent in 2016, added about 102 articles to what body of evidence we had. 27 were insufficient to support any change, and 34 were sufficient but really didn't support a change. And they are living guidelines, so you need to keep up with these, because there's going to be ongoing revisions and not a document like this. There was pediatric guidelines if you take care of kids that you might be want to be aware of in 2019, and I won't go into that. There's some new data coming out that maybe we shouldn't be looking at ICP. Maybe we should be looking more at autoregulation monitoring these patients, so we don't have a lot of literature yet on this, but it's something that we're going to be looking at. Now, when we're dealing with these TBI patients, remember, there's at least 6 different ways of having brain injury in this setting. And you look at the epidural, the contusions, the diffuse axonal injuries, the subdural, subarachnoid, and diffuse swelling. And so that's some of the barriers when we're trying to find treatments for these patients, or, you know, magic pills for this. So it's very difficult. A lot of these patients are overlapping, so the studies are very difficult in them. But some of the things we do know is that we don't want them hypoperfused. We want them not having hypotension, because they have shown in the trauma database, that a single episode of systolic less than 90 will increase your morbidity and double your mortality. And if you're hypoxemic, defined as a PO2 less than 60, poor outcome goes all the way up to 71 from 28 and increases your mortality. The other things we want to do is prevent seizures, as we talked about, watch for electrolyte changes, try and prevent inflammation. So you heard Dr. Biffle talk a little bit about blunt injury, penetrating injury, and there are some guidelines, as he talked about restrictive crystalloids with systolics of 60 to 70 until you've got operative control and blood products are available in blood injury. They're really not great large trials of looking at liberal versus restrictive, but blood pressure is typically about 80 to 90. But for TBI, you know, there's not a whole lot of literature initially, and they looked at, as we talked about, defective autoregulation, that straight line of injury. And I talked about the CPP. So there's, not going through these obviously, but what literature we have and what they put into the new guidelines of 2016 is this. So the PO2 hasn't changed, but the systolic blood pressure, they picked this really confusing. Like before it was easy, we followed the trauma database, and greater than 90 is good. But they decided with all these studies that you'd be greater than 100 if you're 50 to 69, and greater than 110 if you're age 15 to 49 and greater than 7. You're like, heck, that's so hard to remember. So I remember a smiley face. So at the extremes, the younger, so less than, if you're less than, yeah, but you're 15 to 49, you want to be higher, 110. If you're greater than 70, you want to be greater than 110, and in between there at 100. But that's what the guidelines read, just to be confusing. And then for CPP, if you have an ICP monitor, the goals are 60 to 70. So we're going to talk a little bit about trying to manage these patients and not overly aggressively treating those. But so these are what the guidelines are saying now, as we talked about. So those systolics of greater than 100 or greater than 110. If you use medications, there's a little bit of literature, and I think you're all aware, and this happens also in sepsis, is that we're using norepinephrine typically, and it seems to be a little more predictable in our patients for the initial choice. As far as ventilation, we know that we don't want to prolonged hyperventilation, and I'll talk a little bit about that, but just knowing that if you look at this, and sorry, this showed up a little bit small, but as in the autoregulation, we're aware of the blood pressure one, but I think you can see that. Actually, can you see that? I have my arrow here. So if the PCO2 does climb, you're going to vasodilate, so cerebral blood flow goes up, and we're trying to vasoconstrict. That's hyperventilation. But remember, that's happening in good brain. So you may actually have some damage if you do this. The studies have shown that you cause vasoconstriction and reduction in cerebral blood flow in good areas of the brain, and you may slow patients' recovery if you over-hyperventilate them. It's a temporary measure is what the guidelines say, and really try to avoid as much as possible in that first 24 hours, which is where you folks are, is you want to check that PCO2, make sure you're not hyperventilated. The other thing I want to talk about is hemostasis. So you heard a little bit about TXA, the crash study, and when they subsetted this, basically the primary study outcome showed no statistical difference in TBI death in 28 days, but when they subsetted it and found that the patients that were minor head injury, or not minor, but moderate head injury, so greater than 9, so not in the severe category, if you gave 1 gram of TXA over 10 minutes, followed by 1 gram over 8 hours, within 3 hours, there was a mortality benefit, 5.8 versus the 7.5%. And this just shows in the forest plot that, again, in the mild to moderate patients, it did favor TXA versus in severe, it was not helpful. So the patients that you could potentially prevent more bleeding. In patients that have both reactive pupils, is helpful. If you had anisocoria, then it was less helpful. So those, again, in the more severe category, didn't benefit from the TXA. And here, this time is just, the time seems to be the issue that I've been talking about today, but every 20-minute delay resulted in a 10% reduction in being effective. So if you think about it, and the patients in that mild to moderate range, give the TXA. When I think about that patient and I'm standing at the bedside, I'm thinking about the game plan of, in that corner here, the ICP needs to be less than 22. Those are the new guidelines. The CPP needs to be 60 to 70. These patients are intubated. So the first thing I'm thinking about, you've gotten the CT scan, but anybody who's ventilated, who's got a severe TBI is going to be ventilated anyhow. So we try and prevent VAP. They're going to keep the head of the bed up to facilitate venous outflow too, having less in that Monroe-Kelly hypothesis box. We're optimizing the fluid to just make sure they're euvolemic. We don't want them hypervolemic. We want to make sure they're not hot, because every degree Celsius that you're higher increases the metabolic rate, increases the blood flow. We don't want more blood flow or need more blood flow at that time. Also, if they're agitated or having a lot of pain, again, more ICP, because you're a higher ICP because you have more blood flow to the brain because of metabolic rate. So you got them pain, sedated, normal thermic, head of the bed up. That's the bottom line for all your TBI patients. And then I think about when you get into higher ICPs, the rescue temporizing. We talked about the PCO2 briefly for a time, but that's just briefly because we don't want to cause more injury. And then we're going to talk about osmotics. Sometimes we use a paralytic if the patient's well sedated, but they're still rigid. That may sometimes help. And then we go into surgical treatment, CSF drainage, and we'll come back to this pentobarb infusion. More happens in the ICU and surgery. So I mentioned this already, that we're thinking about the cerebral autoregulation curve. And this is just also reminding you that the PO2 needs to be adequate, because if it's below 60 or so, again, vasodilation, more things inside that box. And the PCO2, again, hyperventilation, works almost immediately, very effective, peak effect within 30 minutes. It lowers the ICP about 25 to 30%. But remember, it's decreasing blood flow, so we want to normalize that. So if you use it immediately, make sure you're thinking, and if they're boarding, unfortunately, sometimes that happens in your ER, you want to be thinking about normalizing that PCO2, having them check another gas. What's happening also is that the CO2 is not the direct mediator, it's the pH. It doesn't stop working, but what happens is the choroid plexus, the brain is smarter than us, so the choroid plexus starts exporting the bicarb to lower the pH back to normal. So now you've hyperventilated the patient with a higher minute ventilation, and you don't have any effect. So next time you want to hyperventilate, you need a bigger minute ventilation. So what you want to do is hyperventilate the patient, but normalize that PCO2, decrease their rate by ones at a time so you don't get rebound back to normal after you've gotten that ICP under control. So helpful immediately, but don't leave it higher. So I've shown you this. We talk about the osmotic agent. So mannitol, you folks are all familiar with it. A lot of people are saying, well, should I be using hypertonic saline? I hear that's much better than mannitol. So mannitol still has a place at the bedside, especially if the patient may be wet, but it has a lot of good effects. So it acts quickly also. I always remember the dosing, because when I had my first trauma, medical director we were standing over our bedside. He goes, "How much mannitol, Cheryl?" And I was a medical student at the time, and he goes, 1 gram per kilo, even you can do the math. So 1 gram per kilo is the easy, fast way to do the math of how much mannitol you need when someone's herniating. Very easy to remember. Filtered needles, and the other effects is it has not only that osmotic gradient of pulling, but also can increase fluid in the preload, so it's going to increase your blood pressure as well and your MAP. It makes the red blood cell slippery, the rheology of the red blood cell, so that's helpful in the microcirculation. Also works in the Monroe-Kelly hypothesis of the box, because it decreases your CSF production as well, and it's a free radical scavenger. So still is a good drug. We're using, instead of the old textbooks of a serum osms greater than 320, because we're still using hypertonic saline, we're using a GAP. So the anion gap is your measured osms minus your calculated osms of your equation. Remember, your 2 sodium glucose over 18 BUN over 2.8. If that's greater than 20 in the boost trials and the trials, but if the gap is greater than 20, we're assuming that that gap is mannitol. If that patient, you folks may have patients that are coming in with alcohol and other things, so that unmeasured gap may include alcohol. So you might want to get a baseline serum osms and a gap before you start giving a bunch of mannitol. But this helps us know if you get too much mannitol on board, you can cause ATN. So it's important not to give repetitive doses if the osmolar gap is super high. We have to watch for osmotic diuresis and make sure we're keeping up with fluids. Just a reminder, and this doesn't happen so much in the ED, but mannitol can accumulate in edematous bed, the brain. If you're giving repetitive doses, it's shown that there's a gradient of mannitol in the areas of the brain, and then fluid actually increases in that area. So here's the area of edema. Water follows the mannitol. So you can actually, by giving too much repetitive mannitol at 1 gram per kilo every time, you can cause more problems. So we don't often use it repetitively, frequently. You have that option of hypertonic saline. I'm always asked how much. So 3% saline, 250 cc's, and I've asked how fast? As fast as it goes in. You can run it peripherally. I usually do it through a large antecubital, but obviously it's best if you can get a central line in. But if you're dying, you'd rather have a sclerose vein than be dead. You can. There's some places that use 7%. 23.4 saline does require a central line for the most part. People are talking about putting it interosseous, but I have not done that. It's a 30 cc bolus, equal molar doses of sodium with 3% 250 or the 23.4 at 30 cc's. If the patient's super wet, I use the small 30 cc bullet of 23.4. If the patient needs fluid like they would in the ED, then you would use the larger 3% 250 cc's. The data show, and this is a very old slide, but early on it was showing that in the solid boxes that hypertonic saline may last longer than mannitol. So a lot of people are saying, should be using hypertonic saline more. A lot of studies since then, there's also meta-analysis. That's a whole hour lecture into itself, which we're obviously not going to get into. But equal molar doses of mannitol and hypertonic saline, is kind of bottom line is this. They both work, so you both have them in your back pocket. They've shown that in this particular study that when they did the head-to-head, it seemed that the hypertonic saline was immediately more effective, but mortality, that third bullet, mortality and six-month GOS scores were no different. And I'm not going to go through this for sake of time. Remember, hypernatremia has been shown to have complications. So there's more and more literature showing that people have been giving more hypertonic saline and mortality has been seen to be a little bit higher. You may have more thrombocytopenia, renal failure, neutropenia, and ARDS. And this was in a pediatric population. They've shown in this group, which was in a TBI population, a lot of patients with hypernatremia versus none, that the mortality was higher, increased the length of stay. It may be that those patients were sicker too, but they tried to control for age and the comorbidities, gender, and cerebral edema. And then just to tell you that it's true also in subarachnoid. When they looked at the subarachnoid population, higher sodium was not necessarily good for those patients. The mortality was higher, more complications in pulmonary and kidneys. And then increases inpatient hospitalization, mortality as well. So we don't use hypertonic saline alone. We use the mix of it, and we try to normalize. So sometimes I'll give a patient free water to get the sodium back down. There are guidelines out there talking about using hypertonic saline over mannitol for TBI patients, and that's oftentimes because the patient may be dry when they initially come in, but it's a conditional recommendation, low-quality evidence. Neither of them are expected to improve neurologic outcome per se, and then remember that mannitol is an effective alternative, and avoid hyperchloremia are in the guidelines. Remember to elevate the head of the bed. Brief episodes of hyperventilation and CSF diversion can be helpful, and those are in the guidelines. I'm not going to go into all of those for the sake of time, but I do want to mention fever, that as I talked about, the increasing temperature may increase metabolic rate, which you don't want to do in your patient that's tight, poor compliance, and your ICP goes up as you increase the volume. So we want to make sure that patient is at least, the fever is being treated. Again, sake of time, this is in your handout, but we know that hyperthermia has a lot of injury patterns with increased excitatory amino acids, free radical, and can be problematic. So we don't want our head-injured patients, whether it's stroke or TBI or post-cardiac arrest, to be hot. We call the neurosurgeon for ICP monitoring and EVD placement. Remember that if you have something, and I don't have time to talk about this, but in the cerebellum, where you have an area that can be at risk for posteriors, for the brainstem to be crushed, you want to call the neurosurgeon. So here's your patients. And I'm not going to get into it. These are the cerebellar. Just to mention that decompressive craniectomy in our diffuse traumatic brain injury has not shown that it's actually better. The primary outcome for your Glasgow outcome score was worse with craniectomy, and this was bilateral in patients. And this is showing that the patients that had decompressive craniectomy here had worse outcome than those that did not. So in summary, be aware of those subtle signs and symptoms of intracranial hypertension. Watch for that agitation and hypertension. Don't let you get pushed into just treating the agitation without also thinking, and treating the agitation might be helpful because if they're in pain and they're agitated, treating that will bring down the ICP, but be thinking also that they might be ready to herniate too. So you got to get them to scan. Or consider bolusing the hypertonic saline as a therapeutic diagnostic maneuver if that blood pressure's up. So you might want to treat them with some hypertonic saline as you're thinking about giving them that fentanyl or whatever you're going to do. Consider these non-invasive methods of looking for ICP. And then watch for hyperchloremia if you're treating the patient redundantly with the hypertonic saline. If you're using mannitol, look at your osmolar gap, and know when you need the neurosurgeon. So thank you very much.